Hello, Canada Week listeners. This episode will be broken into two parts as we take a deep dive into the transition away from the illicit market to the legal market. Please enjoy part one.
Welcome back to Canada Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts in the industry weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. We are excited for our first guest to welcome him back. He has 10 years experience in the legal cannabis industry and is considered a national expert in the diverse licensing regimes governing each state. He's the founder and managing partner at Merida Capital Partners. Please welcome back Mitch Marukowicz. And our next guest is, now I feel like my partner in crime on here. He's a pioneering thought leader in the cannabis industry and the fearless leader of our amazing research team here at New Frontier Data. Please welcome our chief knowledge officer, Mr. John Cagia.
Delighted to be back, Heather. Thank you.
Well, we have lots to cover, and I know you guys have a lot of great insights for us, so we're going to dive right in. Last week, FreshToast.com reported a global pandemic has caused legal marijuana to cannibalize the black market. So the battle between the illicit and legal market is an ongoing issue. Obviously, it's tricky to have a solid number on illicit sales since dealers aren't exactly offering up their sales numbers, but it's estimated to be around four times the legal market. And now with this pandemic, things are changing. It would seem consumers are now prioritizing health and safety above a cheaper product. Mitch, you're actually quoted in here stating that the recent growth is due to consumers transitioning away from the black market to the legal market. So my first question, Mitch, is to you. Why do you believe the industry is having such a hard time competing with the black market, especially even in areas that offer like recreational adult use like Colorado and California?
Right. The irony of discussing an article using that data is that not only did it quote us, but I was using New Frontier Data to write an article that was then quoted everywhere. So it's very cyclical. So I guess I'm quoting
all those lead to us.
Information on my own quoted. So it's a little self-deprecating. But and John was phenomenal about if you saw the email back and forth, because we think this is a fundamentally maybe the largest issue for people to focus on over the next year or two as you see the maturation of many of the MSOs. But you know, it's interesting to look at why the industry is having, I don't think it's actually having a hard time competing with the legacy illicit market. I think it's actually doing a great job, but I think you have to fundamentally focus on the consumer behavior aspects of it, right? We're in a place now where a lot of the cannabis companies have, they've built their infrastructure, they spent the CapEx, especially in the US, right? You have a pretty fast maturing industry, and then you run into consumer behavior then at that point. So the legacy, you think of legacy behavior and people walking around dealing with illicit dealers and illicit supply chain. And so the early, when you had a broad illegality in the cannabis market, when it could even be called a market in 2000, 1995, all the way forward, you then look at the behavior that people start to develop. So the early adopters in the legal market in cannabis were probably heavy users in the illicit market. And those people were willing to take all kinds of legal risks to consume the product. And I think it's really hard to fundamentally change that behavior of, I have a friend who grows, he has a good supply, it's being delivered to me. So when, you know, and John was fundamental in helping me develop this thesis of what are the differences between the legal market and the illicit market? And what we really came down to at the end is, I think the legal market's doing a phenomenal job of providing what we call the consumer quartet, quality, safety, access and choice. The one area that the legal market is still struggling to really compete with is price. And I think John actually made this point to me, which is, and I don't want to speak for John because he can definitely speak well for himself, but price is something that we think will regress over time. So I want to just, I'm not pushing back on the thesis that the legal market still has a long way to go because the illicit market is just so much larger. But I do think that the legal market is competing and doing a great job in everywhere but price so far.
I actually saw on LinkedIn that you responded to someone that was saying how we shouldn't even be considering the illicit market a competitor necessarily.
Well, I hear all kinds of things every day, but you know, there's about 12,000 other people who read the commentary we put out that actually wrote, you know, that many of them commented about this is an eye-opening thing and how COVID put it into context. Again, using a lot of New Frontier data that I couldn't have made the points I was trying to make. But if you look at the consumer aspects, it's unequivocal that this is the first year where you're truly going to see on a gross or an absolute basis, the legal market really wipe the floor with the illicit market in terms of growth, right? Cannabis consumption is growing 3, 4, 5% total. And the legal market is grabbing the lion's share of that growth now. And John, I mean, I guess you have more data than I do, but I think that's going to be the more of the norm going forward.
Yeah, completely agree with that assessment, Mitch. And I think there's kind of two fundamental points that need to be framed as you understand how this market is evolving. One, legalization, the initial part of a legal market's growth is not about creating new consumers. And I think that's something that a lot of stakeholders who aren't observing the space just fail to understand. The idea isn't that legalization is going to persuade somebody who has never consumed cannabis to now walk into a dispensary and buy cannabis for the first time. The overwhelming proportion of demand is going to be from consumers who are well versed with cannabis, have been consuming it likely for a long time, have been very comfortable accepting the risks associated with participating in the illicit market, and now are weighing the options available to them in the legal market and trying to make that assessment. And to Mitch's point about, you know, the quartet of issues that the legal market leads on, which are safety, choice, access,
quality, and access, yeah,
and quality, is that while all of those are really important in persuading consumers to transition from their illegal sources to the legal market, price remains that critical hinging factor. And they're willing to pay a premium for those four elements, but they're not willing to pay, you know, 100% more just for the benefit of those, because they've had really good success with a very efficient, unregulated market. They're happy with the products that they have, even though they may not realize just how much better the products are in the legal market. And so once you start getting that price, it doesn't need to be parity. It doesn't need to be a one-to-one price comparison between the legal and illicit market. It just needs to be close enough that the consumer sees the value of getting that higher quality product, doing it in a safe location, being able to purchase it in a way that's really convenient, that they're willing to pay that incremental 10, 15, 20% more. And once you get that legal market price point to within 20% of the unregulated market, then you're able to really ignite that transition from the unregulated to the legal market. And I think that's what we're seeing now in most legal markets. Taxation plays a critical role in this, but even in places where taxes are quite high, like California, ultimately the market gains such economies of scale that even with high taxes, just the scale at which cannabis is being produced brings those prices down. And that's when you see that accelerated transition, particularly as consumers start to see the benefits of being in the legal market with the quality, with the products.
And you know, John, the one other fundamental point that absolutely drives home that is, in certain markets, you're going to see the use skew to older consumers. Those are people that primarily, I mean, most people aren't discovering cannabis for the first time at 70 years old. They're legacy users who have walked into a dispensary and are wildly blown away by the choice, the packaging, the labeling, the certainty of product. I mean, but the choice, like I said, that we call it the consumer quartet. Obviously, that's a Merida created construct. It really is that construct. When someone in the legacy market goes, and you know, as we've spoken about, you know, at length, I think the important thing is COVID actually helped disrupt enough of the supply chain that people, legacy users, actually felt compelled to go into legal, and once, you know, into legal locations, and once they saw what is available for them on the legal market, that, you know, there used to be this like pinky in the air elitist being like, oh, you're going to a legal dispensary. I've got this guy who grows 12 plants a year. It's wonderful. It's, you know, it's so craft. And then that person walks into the dispensary and they're like, whoo, I just saw 46 different kinds of variety. Like you could do THC by, you know, if you do it by numbers, it's like the Dewey Decimal System. I mean, you can literally get anything you want in legal dispensaries for the most part.
Absolutely. Yeah. That initial dispensary experience, particularly for the long-time unregulated market consumer who is a connoisseur in the unregulated market, but they're a connoisseur on a very, very narrow band of types of products. So they don't know anything about edibles. They don't know anything about the vape market. They may have some orientation to flower and to concentrates, but even that tends to be in a fairly rudimentary way. That first experience, particularly when they walk into a well-developed, well-executed dispensary experience, it becomes very, very difficult for the illicit market to compete with that on a sustained basis. And that's the power of choice.
You know what we call that, actually? We have, and then we can move on to another subject. I have an image to put in your mind for those of you who know game shows in the U.S. For Merida, we call that the supermarket sweep moment. Mm-hmm. That's the illicit market guy just sweeping everything with all his arms off the shelf as fast as he can. So,
yeah. No, it's funny that you're saying that you don't know any 70-year-old. I actually have 2 70-year-old relatives that have never smoked weed, consumed it at all, but had like knee replacement or some kind of surgery. And they were so afraid of opioids, you know, they didn't want to take them to go to sleep. And so, you know, my husband and I both were like, why don't you try this?
And yeah, they're, I mean, look, obviously there are going to be new consumers of every stripe, old, young, medical.
Yeah.
But for the reality is when you see legacy users are obviously going to be older than 21 because those people grew up in legal market. Like essentially if you're 16 or 17 and you were, you know, I'm not in any way condoning anyone that isn't of age consume anything, right? You know, we should try to discourage youth use as much as possible. But people who grew up in the modern, you know, the last decade have pretty much never understood what pure illegality means and what people in California or other markets really suffered through and why choice was so constrained and why there were medical cooperatives. They don't even understand the legacy. And really, they're in a new world. It's a totally new paradigm to them. And so that's why if you're finding, like John and I were talking about, the real hardcore legacy users, they're transitioning. They're going to be 40, 50, 60, because those are people who already accepted all of the risks of participation in a wildly illegal market compared to today.
Yeah. Well, I have a question for you then. What steps, if any, can lawmakers take to like kind of keep that trend going towards people moving towards the legal market away from the black?
So there's two trends that we've actually been following. I mean, John already nailed the first one, so I'll keep it really short. Taxation has to be well thought out. And I think a lot of states are looking at it as revenue drivers. And so they have to be a little smarter, like John said, to try to create a parity so that whatever you pay in taxes as an operator that's passed on to consumer can be then made up in volume and scale. But I will add one other element that we're seeing as a trend, and I haven't really seen it widely covered, so I'm happy to introduce it on like a data-driven platform like New Frontier, is you're really seeing in the last 3 to 4 years, you know, I grew up in the early medical markets when the regulators were someone who, it might've been the guy who raised his hand at the wrong time in a Department of Health meeting or a pharmacy meeting or something. And so the regulators really weren't dedicated cannabis regulators. And what you're noticing over the last 2 to 3 years is really, whether it's Michigan with the MRA, whether it's the BCC, which, you know, was originally a totally another agency, or the MCC in Maryland, you know, a lot of these states have been smart about creating actually dedicated regulatory groups who manage these. So that means more understanding of the space, a better understanding of the consumer. You get a more dedicated effort. And because of that, you get a more responsive effort, which was essential in COVID, right? The responsiveness of most of the states to COVID was fast, effective, accurate, and precise. You don't often get that with regulation, but for some reason, because these regulators are, you know, in Massachusetts, a perfect example, you have a great regulator who's really plugged into what's happening on the ground. And you get that in a lot of states. And I think early on in the first 5 or 6 years of cannabis' evolution from 2010 to 15, you had these regulatory groups that weren't as familiar. Actually, they were being educated in real time alongside the operators and the consumer. And now you're getting dedicated groups who can rely on New Frontier data and other sources to make better decisions. And they can go to an industry group and have discussions that really lead to real-time solutions. So I think actually we're closer than we've ever been to getting the kind of responsiveness on the regulatory side to get a real cohesive and cogent thought on taxes. But taxation, it all starts and stops with that for me. I know John referenced that before, but I still think the taxation in many places is, if not unfair, it doesn't understand, it shouldn't be taxed necessarily the way it's taxed or it should be maybe like a value-added tax rather than just a gross excise tax or some other element. So, I mean, that's our view, but I think that we're moving that direction as regulators get more educated. And I think that we're already well on that way because of this professionalized regulatory operators who are now much more responsive to the industries.
I would just add to that, and I agree with everything that you've said, Mitch. And I think that's a great kind of perspective on what the regulators should be doing, which is be focused on this because this is a very dynamic, very complex environment and critical that you have that your attention is focused, that you're kind of tailoring the responses specifically to this really unique market in our economy. But on the lawmaker side, you know, I think fundamentally one of the things that I think is still lacking, particularly at the federal level, is understanding who the American cannabis consumer is. You know, the fact that we still see such a great disconnect between the public's view toward legalization on a national basis what Congress or the White House and federal governing authorities are willing to do, I think is partly deeply rooted in this idea of, at the national lawmaker level, there's almost a complete disconnect in understanding between the understanding of legalization and abstraction and understanding who the cannabis consumer actually is. And I think if, as on a national basis, we had a much more intimate view into the cannabis consumer, into the homes of the cannabis consumer, it makes it real in a way that I think will help dramatically accelerate the national conversation on why so much of our federal discussion around cannabis remains so punitive, why we've seen such a kind of acute disconnect between the progress made at the state level versus progress being made at the federal level. And third, once we appreciate who is consuming cannabis in America and understand acutely that the cannabis consumer in America represents America, it is about as diverse socioeconomically, ethnically, racially as you can get. This is across, you know, the cannabis consumer is the American, then I think there'll be much more urgency in this idea of, if this is truly the emergence of a global economy, what role can America play in leading this emergence? There's a lot of, you know, for all that has happened at the state level, cannabis as a global economy is not going to happen until the US plays an important role, a catalytic role in both stimulating the conversation and helping the global market understand the consumer and the market in which the consumer lives. And I think there's still a long way from that happening at the federal level. And that's largely because the federal lawmakers don't understand who the cannabis consumer is.
Yeah, I mean, that's first of all, it's a completely spot on point. And I think when you think of the, you know, people always ask, it's like the first question when you talk to someone who's casually knowledgeable about cannabis is, what's going to happen at the federal level? And I, you know, we often as investors say, you know, it doesn't really matter. A lot of our portfolio companies are clearly, we're investing with this view. Merida has a very specific view of what legalization, quote unquote legalization looks like, whether it's a descheduling. And we think there's certain, you know, industries like companies like New Frontier that benefit wildly from, you know, when all of a sudden everything becomes a fire hose instead of a drip, right? And people have to consume and get their head around. But I do think that people do underestimate how important it is that states have extremely stable regimes going into that federalization in some way, whether it's a descheduling or otherwise. You know, early on, we used to make a joke, you know, this is 2013, so it's like ancient history, but we used to make a joke about how every state, you know, it's like they might borrow some elements, but they all have to have their own recipe for a cannabis. Like, why not just copy the two or three states that are working, right? Connecticut has a good regime, but their lab testing is tighter. Colorado does this brighter. And, you know, what you realize is local, there's geographic differences. And I think those elements, regulators also want to feel like they've taken what works and then reduce risk even further, or taken steps that reduce, you know, that risk further. And I think that does skew things, whether it's taxation. You know, regulators now almost look at it as a quid pro quo. If I'm going to legalize, then I want to resolve another issue that we're facing at the state level, revenue or whatever it is. And I think that's why COVID, you know, when we first said COVID is like changing the cannabis industry, we weren't saying it flippantly, but everyone thought we kind of were. But we were actually saying that we think it's going to fundamentally change the mindset. It's going to make regulators much more open. It's going to they're going to look at it as this kind of, you know, bargaining piece. And we haven't seen, you know, no states legalized in the COVID world. But clearly by 2021, you're talking about Arizona rec on the ballot. You know, the states that can do ballot measures are moving forward very quickly with it. And the states that can't, like a Virginia, Missouri, they're looking at rec very seriously, even though they're very early in their medical regime, largely because of what you just said.
Thank you for joining us at Canna Week. This concludes part one. Stay tuned for part two. And please remember to like and subscribe to the podcast. You can find these news stories and more on New Frontier Data's Cannabis Insights Daily. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. See you next time.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.